I was just commenting during the break. I went to bed last night dreaming, not dreaming, just sort of hypnagogically reviewing all of this material that I wanted to talk about. And while I was doing this, as I was just sort of at the threshold of maybe getting to sleep, this great serpentine eye of infinite evil confronted me. It's sort of like Sauron's eye. And I knew what it was, and I didn't want to lose it. I wanted to concentrate on it and see it. And I, for some period of time, I sat contemplating this thing, trying to understand it. That's the sort of bizarre person that you have talking to you tonight. Sorry. Okay.
So you analyzed as any physician would.
I went to sleep, actually. Eventually. It's like, okay, enough. Go away, enough. The Sacrificial Murder, the Eighth Adventure. He starts by saying, "But this was the vision I did not want to see." It's like, holy shit, at this point, this is the vision you don't want to see? Okay. The Sacrificial Murder. "But this was the vision that I did not want to see. The horror that I did not want to live. A sickening feeling of nausea streaks up on me. An abominable, perfidious serpents wind their slow and crackling way through parched undergrowth. They hang down lazily and disgustingly lethargic from the branches, looped in dreadful knots. I am reluctant to enter this dreary and unsightly valley, where the bushes stand in arid, stony defiles. The valley looks so normal. Its air smells of crime, of foul, cowardly deeds. I am seized by disgust and horror. I walk hesitantly over the boulders, avoiding every dark place for fear of treading on a serpent. The sun shines weakly out of a gray and distant sky, and all the leaves are shriveled. A marionette with a broken head lies before me amid the stones. A few steps further, a small apron. And then behind the bush, the body of a small girl, covered with terrible wounds, smeared with blood. One foot is clad with a stocking and shoe. The other is naked and gorily crushed. The head. Where is the head? The head is a mash of blood with hair and whitish pieces of bone surrounded by stones smeared with brain and blood. My gaze is captivated by this awful sight. A shrouded figure, like that of a woman, is standing calmly next to the child. Her face is covered by an impenetrable veil. She asks me, "What then do you say?" Jung, "What should I say? This is beyond words." G. she asks. Do you understand this, Jung? I refuse to understand such things. I can't speak about them without becoming enraged. She, why become enraged? You might as well rage every day of your life, for these and similar things occur every day. But most of the time we don't see them, she. So knowing that they happen is not enough to enrage you? Jung. If I merely have knowledge of something, it's easier and simpler. The horror is less real if all I have is knowledge. She. Step nearer, and you will see that the body of the child has been cut open. Take out the liver. There is only one atonement. Abase yourself and eat. Jung. I cannot. I refuse. I cannot participate in this horrible guilt. She. You share this guilt. I share this guilt. She. You are a man, and a man has committed this deed. Jung. Yes, I am a man. I curse whoever did this for being a man, and I curse myself for being a man. She. So take part in his act. Abase yourself and eat. I need atonement. Jung. So shall it be for your salve, as you are the soul of this child. I kneel down on the stone. Cut off a piece of the liver and put it in my mouth. My gorge rises. Tears burst from my eyes. Cold sweat covers my brow. A dull, sweet taste of blood. I swallow with desperate efforts. It is impossible. Once again, I almost faint. It is done. The horror is accomplished. She. I thank you. She throws her veil back. A beautiful maiden with ginger hair. She. Do you recognize me? Jung. How strangely familiar you are. Who are you? She. I am your soul. Can anyone analyze that vision for me? What's happening?
Acknowledge and accept the evil that's within us, it's a part of us, makes us a beautiful soul.
I think, too, maybe your earlier point, that's where he begins to own his part in things, too. Almost like you begin to get your own power.
Does doing this make him beautiful? Does it make... Does he experience redemption? Does he... Is there any joy in this? Or is it simply a fact of something that he has to accept?
He atones the spirit. He atones and alleviates his spirit's distress.
His soul's distress.
His soul's distress.
Somewhat. You see, at the end here, the soul of this girl says, "I thank you." And she throws back her veil. She insisted that he do this. The soul of this slain child insists that he do this. And he does.
Seems like a parallel to the Christian sacrament.
Parallel?
Couldn't hear that.
Seems like a parallel to the Christian sacrament.
Or the Mayan sacrifices.
Or Mayan sacrifices, ripping bloody hearts out of living souls and offering them to the sun. Well,
and then the eagle that eats the liver every night, and it grows back enough that he's still alive. Is that Perseus? He gets his liver eaten. Prometheus, the original man.
Let me read you his commentary. The sacrifice has been accomplished. The divine child, the image of the God's formation, is slain. And I have eaten from the sacrificial flesh. Man must recognize his complicity in the act of evil. He must bear witness to his recognition by eating from the bloody sacrificial flesh. Through this act, he testifies that he is a man, that he recognizes good as well as evil, and that he destroys the image of the God's formation through withdrawing his life force, with which he also dissociates himself from the God. This occurs for the salvation of the soul, which is the true mother of the divine child. This occurs for the salvation of the soul, which is the true mother of the divine child. That's a complex passage. Man must recognize complicity. And I wouldn't let women entirely off the hook here either. Women, you're accomplices as well. Okay. In the act of evil, man must bear witness and recognize this. Through this, he testifies that he is a man, that he recognizes good as well as evil. And here's the strange thing. And that he destroys the image of God's formation through withdrawing his life force, with which he also dissociates himself from the God. That's a confusing sentence. Jung has regenerated Istvar. Bright sun god flies off like the sunbird. Something in Jung wants to go with that up into heaven. Can't. He's here. He's a man. He has to deal with this bag of flesh that he is. He has to know what it is to be a man. He can't pretend that he is a sun god. He can't tag along on the wings of that bird and lift his feet, his flesh, his consciousness from the fact of earth. One One of Jung's critiques of Christianity was that, amongst several critiques, four principal critiques that he was developing at this time, is that Christianity had failed to live its animal, to understand the animal nature, to accept animal nature. Natalie made a comment something like that earlier. You know, if the bright God flies up and is all up there, outside of ourself, exteriorized, well, where's all evil? Well, where's all darkness? I guess it's us. We're the fallen thing. We're the empty thing. We are the sinful thing. And then in this entire spiritual motive of humanity, well, we don't want anything to do with that. We want to be atoned, taken up to the bright. Jung felt that part of that atonement was our at-one-ment, coming to fact with our flesh, with what we were, with animal instinctuality, with murderousness, with an infinite evil. Infinite evil that we could see, experience, that eye of evil that we could see. I've had the unfortunate duties of taking care of children like this, people like this, over the course of my life. I know how you feel about that. I know how you feel about the perpetrator of such a thing. The hardest fact that a man ever meets is that he is such a man, that he could be that. By grace of God, by grace of powers unknown to us, perhaps we stand here, not yet that thing. But it happens. We feel those things sometimes. We know they're in us sometimes. They're there. They're part of our nature. Doing this, facing this fact in himself, was coming to terms with what it was to be human. There's the universal law of this place we live really cycles around one question. From its primal origins, one question, maybe two questions. Do I eat it, or does it eat me? Now, you can hold a carrot in your hand and feel very comfortable with that proclamation and question. Look a tiger or a bear in the nose.
I don't think when we're taking communion, it occurs that it's cannibalism.
You know, the general exegesis given to catechumens on the, at least within Episcopalian and within Roman rites, is that the Eucharist is approached in two ways. It's a sacred meal, and it is a sacrifice. A sacrifice and a meal. Now, it was mentioned that this...
Eating sacrificial meals.
And yet here, this sacrifice is the sacrifice of a man who is a God who is dying for man. And that in that eating, we're partaking of sacrifice, of the act of sacrifice. It could go in mystical contemplation far beyond dogmatics and the class given to most catechumens. And it has in the mystical contemplations of Christianity. He says he destroys the image of God's formation. He destroys the image of God's formation. You know, we want brightness, we want light, we want to be good. And I suppose if you feel that you've incubated the egg of God, you've regenerated the God image in your own time. That could be a fairly inflating thought. Might well walk out of that particular vision, thinking that I am a new prophet. He had to deflate that fact of his humanity, that humanity which could regenerate the brightness, the lightness of a God image, that humanity was the same humanity, this same evil, potential of evil. Is that real evil? Is that absolute evil? I don't know. What did Jung say about that? I experience evil. I experience good. I experience God. Experience. We experience evil, whether it's absolute, a metaphysical construct, I don't know. It doesn't matter to me. I know what it is because I have experienced it. I have seen it. So have you. It's real. And it's part of our humanity. Jung said that our psychological development, our coming to terms with this God in us, which is what Jung's psychological development is about, if you think about it. Once again, you're using that nasty three-letter word, the big word. But that is how Jung found these things. Coming to an confrontation, an honest confrontation with the nature within us, which speaks like a force of God. Coming to terms with that involved coming to terms with evil as experienced. We're not talking about metaphysical constructs, and good and bright and light as experienced. Once again, not abstracted into a metaphysical fact. And this is Jung's commentary on that piece of the Liber Novus, that piece of liver. He says, and here he's, once again, he's speaking about this whole process he's going through at this time. Sometimes you no longer recognize yourself. You want to overcome it, but it overcomes you. You want to set limits, but it compels you to keep going. You want to elude it, but it comes with you. You want to employ it, but you are its tools. You want to think about it, but your thoughts obey it. Finally, the fear of the inescapable seizes you, for it comes after you slowly and invincibly. There is no escape. So it is that you come to know what a real God is. Now, you'll think up clever truisms, preventive measures, secret escape routes, excuses, potions capable of inducing forgetfulness. But it's all useless. The fire burns right through you. That which guides forces you onto the way. But the way is my own self, my own life founded upon myself. that God wants my life. He wants to go with me, sit at the table with me, work with me. Above all, he wants to be ever present. But I'm ashamed of God, of my God. I don't want to be divine, but reasonable. The divine appears to me as irrational craziness. I hate it as an absurd disturbance of my meaningful human activity. It seems an unbecoming sickness which has stolen into the regular course of my life. Yes, I even find the divine superfluous. As we go through each of these passages of the Red Book, I suppose one could give an exegesis, take points away from them in building some sort of a dogma of, or evaluation of Jung's psychology. To really understand this, you have to live them. Let these events come into your life. Imagine what it would be to be there with them. If you can do that to any degree, and then confront this man's struggle with them. This commentary is written just a year later. Jung had a whole lot more to say over subsequent years about this in his private journals that are not part of the Red Book. There are two of his Black Book journals that are not represented much at all in the Red Book. And these journals may someday be published. Stuff went on after he finished this piece. His psychology was not completely formed. His understanding of light and dark, of good and evil, was not fixed. It was encountered. It was a living experience in him. And as he says right here, I hate it as an absurd disturbance of my meaningful activity. In the year 1914, I imagine Carl Gustav Jung was not too happy about the journey he had felt that he had to take. He felt he had to do it. He called it his most dangerous experiment. He had to keep going. You want to overcome it, but it overcomes you. You want to set limits. I'm sure he wanted to set a limit before those last two visions. But it compels you to keep going. You want to elude it, but it comes with you. It's part of you. Finally, the fear of the inescapable seizes you, for it comes after you slowly and invincibly. The inner God image met, the inner God image that he had met, the inner God image met has both light and dark qualities. Jung met opposites in the imaginal journey inward. They were conflictual. Light, dark, good, evil, spirit, flesh, and the soul is increasingly his intermediary between them. Am I wearing you guys out?
I have a question that may be totally off topic. What do you think about what we've been talking about in reference to children of Susan Powell that were just brutally murdered?
Now tell me what you think about it.
Over and over it just seems like whenever we're confronted with these terrible things, we, try to push them away, separate them from us, and, try to obviously demonize the perpetrator and make that human being so different than what we are that we could never have that within us. Things like that.
And we love to see it, apparently, speaking about Nielsen television ratings. It seems to make a difference to Nielsen television ratings if we can have lots of that on our 5 p.m., 6 p.m., 8 a.m. news. Yeah, sensationalized, demonized. We can put the devil up there and say, my gosh, I'm not one of them. And yet, what fascinates us? Why do we want to know all the details, huh?
Because we do want to experience it.
Because it's a part of us.
It is. It's a part of our experience.
The delicate balance that it creates between light and darkness, between evil and God. And those dichotomies that he presents, they're all in us.
Yes.
And it's capable. Obviously, not everybody reached that point of godness or devilness, but there is both fused into us. And that's the inescapable.
Inescapable. That's exactly what Jung said. It's inescapable. It's with me.
I think of what Maya Angelou said. Don't ever look at anything that another human being has done and say, I could never be like that. Because if a human being has done it, you could be like that. And instead, you say, I pray I will never be like that.
Yeah. And that prayer is like the silver fishing rod stuck in the eye of infinite evil. You know, if you're holding that fishing rod in the eye of that evil, and you're aware that you're holding it, it's when the serpent comes from behind, and you don't even know the eye, and the eye becomes you. Are you guys getting an idea of what Jung was talking about when he talked about the opposites?
Everywhere.
I just heard a beautiful statement of the nature of opposites. It's an existential fact. We live it. I was talking to a Jungian analyst who had been to her meeting for a Jungian analyst, and there was a lady there that she'd been talking to who complained to her, says, all this stuff, opposites, opposite, opposites. I get so tired of this Jung opposite stuff. We really have to move on from this. And the person who was telling me the story just shook her head and says, you know, where in the hell is that sort of idea coming from? You know, that's post-Jungian. You gotta get past, you know, we gotta move on. Move on to the new. You know, get past opposites. How the hell do you get past the opposites in our experience, in our psychological, in our intrapsychic experience? And you think about how these opposites play in Jungian psychology. You can line them up conceptually, right? But forget the conceptualization, forget the nice lines that you can draw on a blackboard and put this on this side and that on that side. It's not a concept, it's our experience. We conceptualize about our experience. Divide it up. And then there's this other thing about opposites. And this really came up in that comment about the murder, about the murderer. We tend to project opposites, right? So, do we always hate opposites? No, sometimes we love them. If you meet your opposite, it's like, are we going to make love or are we going to fight? You know, sometimes it's both in marriage, as best I can tell. We project opposites out. We see opposites. Shadow brothers, dark and light, male and female, thinking and feeling. There is a desire, ultimately, for some sort of a wedding, some sort of a unification, some sort of an accord. And often it devolves into warfare and hatred. Isn't that the story of many marriages? Something wonderful is projected out onto this other individual. It's called love. we want union with the opposite. Then we come into closer contact with the opposite and we find out that what we really are involved in is warfare. All we want to do is get the hell out of the war. Where's the solution in that? How do you get there? Jung said in his affirmation of knowing God that I read earlier, God is an apt name given to all overpowering emotions in my psychical system, subduing my conscious will and usurping control over myself. Yes. If it overcomes you? Have you ever heard of an angry God? A jealous God? A wrathful God? Ever heard of one of those? Oh my. Yeah. You see, and that's all that, you know, that all of that. That stuff, all that complexio, the complexio oppositorum is in that Jehovah image, to speak theologically, which I probably shouldn't, but I will speak theologically, and highly undifferentiated. He can be wrathful. The children can come and mock the prophet. And so what does God do? He sends bears out of the forest to eat the children. Oh, watch out for that dude.
Where's the devil?
Well, that's got to be in you. Couldn't be God. And God's like all good and bright, and he may have jealousy and wrath and hatred and meanness, but he's all good and bright. So if there's a devil, must be you.
Probably true.
Or alternatively, we might see that this question of where is the devil and where is God? Opposites. Opposites. Oh my. Where might the ground of opposites be? Might it be in the differentiating fact of human consciousness? Might we be the differentiation of the pleroma, of the fullness? Might we be Abraxas in this world, the fiery one who divides and calls good and bad, who knows, experiences good and evil? Jung really felt that when he gave that lecture on psychology and religion in 1937 at Yale University, he really felt a time had come where, as he said to the BBC listening audience in 1960, we cannot use medieval ideas to deal with our experience of the religious. We're not using medieval ideas to deal with our cosmos, with the nature of our nature, our medicine. But when it comes to the psyche, and that most primary experience of the psyche, which can be called a religious experience, a living experience of inner truths, we are bringing to the table of our discussion often words, tools, concepts, which were left in the dusty back room of Christian theology, of Jewish theology, of Islamic theology, 10 centuries ago. Jung was saying, okay, let's take a look at the empirical fact of our experience. And he started with the empirical fact of his own experience. He had to go there. That's what motivated him on this journey. That's why he kept going. He had to find out. Well, Okay, thank God the eighth adventure is over. That's the one we just finished. That's the eighth adventure.
I mean, which God you
were. Oh. Damn duelists. Okay, the ninth adventure. It lightens up. It lightens up a bit. And okay, you talk about the complexio oppositorum, the nature of opposites. Well, in Jung's experience, it's like a roller coaster. Light and dark, light and dark. It's going through this roller coaster of experience. So the next adventure is called The Divine Folly, and it goes on for several nights at the end of January. And this is how it starts. I am in a high hall. Before me I see a green curtain between two columns. The curtain parts easily. I see into a small, deep room with bare walls. There is a small window with bluish glass above it. I set foot on the stair leading up to this room between the pillars and enter. In the rear wall, I see a door right and left. It's as if I must choose between right and left. Are we just talking about opposites? Right and left. He chooses the right door and he enters a library. The librarian is sitting there. Jung walks up. He says, I'm somewhat embarrassed since I don't know what I really want. Thomas A. Kempis crosses my mind. Jung, speaking to the librarian. I'd like to have Thomas A. Kempis's The Imitation of Christ. He, the librarian, looks at me somewhat astonished as if he didn't credit me with such an interest. He gives me an order form to fill out. I too think it's astonishing to ask for Thomas A. Kempis. Jung asks the librarian, are you surprised I'm requesting Thomas's work? The librarian, well, yes. The book is seldom asked for. And I wouldn't have expected this interest from you. Jung, I must confess that I'm somewhat surprised by this inspiration. But recently I came across a passage from Thomas that made a particular impression on me. Why, I can't really say. If I remember correctly, it dealt with the problem of the imitation of Christ. The librarian, do you have a particular theological or philosophical interest? Jung, do you mean whether I want to read it for the purpose of prayer? Librarian, well, hardly. Jung, if I read Thomas A. Kempis, I do so for the sake of prayer, or something similar, rather than out of scholarly interest. The librarian, are you religious? I had no idea. Jung, you know that I value science extraordinarily highly, but there are actually moments in life where science also leaves us empty and sick. In such moments, a book like Thomas's means very much to me, since it is written from the soul. Librarian, but somewhat old-fashioned. We can no longer get involved in Christian dogmatics these days, surely. Jung, we haven't come to an end with Christianity by simply putting it aside. It seems to me that there's more to it than we see. The librarian, what is there about it? It's just a religion. Then Jung gives this commentary. He says, the divine wants to live with me. My resistance is in vain. I asked my thinking, and it said, take as your model one that shows you how to live the divine. Our natural model is Christ. We have stood under his law since antiquity, first outwardly and then inwardly. At first we knew this, and then we knew it no longer. We fought against Christ. We deposed him. We seemed to be conquerors. But he remained in us and mastered us. It is better to be thrown into visible chains than into invisible ones. You can certainly leave Christianity, but it does not leave you. Your liberation from it is delusion. Christ is the way. You can certainly run away, but then you are no longer on the way. The way of Christ ends on the cross. But if I truly understand Christ, I must realize how Christ actually lived only his own life and imitated no one. He did not emulate any model. But acceptance of the other means a descent into the opposite. From seriousness into the laughable, from suffering into the cheerful, from beauty into the ugly, from pure into the impure. He walks out of the library. He's back in the anteroom. Door now he goes in the left door. So he's been in the library with the librarian, having a talk about Thomas A. Kempis. The librarian thinks, you know, it's a bit strange that a modern man would want to read this sort of stuff. He was a bit surprised, too. Something about this imitation of Christ, though, seems to be on his mind. Seems to be thinking something about a cross as well. Goes into the left room. And he's surprised he walks into a kitchen. There's an old cook there at the table. And he walks in and talks to her, and he has this little book with him. And she looks at him and says, "Are you a pastor?" And Jung replies, "No, why do you ask?" And she says, "Well, my mother had a little book like that, and this is the sort of book that pastors read. And in fact, my mother gave me that book on her deathbed and advised me to read it. And throughout my life, I've read the book, and it's given me comfort." And Jung asked her, "What was the name of the book your mother gave you?" And she said, "Well, it was The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis," which is, of course, the book he has. Here's the librarian. Librarian. With all his books. Left-hand door. Into the kitchen. Here's a woman cooking food. She sees the book. What does she remember? That it was a book that was sacred to her mother. Her mother gave it to her on her deathbed and advised her to read it. A few points. So Jung sits down in the kitchen. He starts to read his book. He sits there and he thinks, now what is supposed to happen next? He says, "I would like to imitate Christ, but an inner disquiet seizes me. What is supposed to happen? I hear an odd swishing and whirling, and suddenly a roaring sound fills the room like a horde of large birds with frenzied flapping wings. I see many shadow-like human forms rushing past. I hear a manifold babble of voices utter the word, 'Let us pray in the temple.' A horde of ghostly figures have just come running into the kitchen. Jung says to them, 'Where you're rushing off to?' A bearded man with tousled hair and dark shining eyes stops and turns toward me. 'We are wandering to Jerusalem to pray at the Holy Sepulchre.' Jung says to the old guy, 'Take me with you.' The man says, 'You cannot join us. You have a body. We are dead.' Jung says, 'Who are you? The old fellow says, I am Ezekiel, and I am an Anabaptist. You have to understand, the Anabaptist movement was a radical form of Protestant Christianity that didn't feel that Luther and Zwingli had gone far enough in their reforms from the liturgical forms of the Protestant Church. And the Anabaptist movement really took form in 1520, about 10 blocks from Jung's house in Zollerkan. It's one subway stop, one trolley stop past Kusnacht, where Jung was living. So these ghosts actually did have a provenance in this particular kitchen, shall we say. So he says, I am Ezekiel, I am an Anabaptist. And who are those wandering with you? Ezekiel replies, they are my fellow believers. Jung asks, why are you wandering? Ezekiel, we cannot stop, but must make a pilgrimage to all the holy places. Jung, what drives you to this? Ezekiel, I don't know. But it seems that we still have no peace, although we died in true belief. Jung, why do you have no peace if you died in true belief? Ezekiel, it always seems to me as if we had not come to a proper end with life. Jung, remarkable. How so? Ezekiel, it seems to me that we forgot something important that should also be lived. Jung, and what was that? And then Ezekiel looks at him, and Ezekiel says, would you happen to know? And with these words, he reaches out greedily, uncannily towards me, his eyes shining with inner heat. So Ezekiel, the ghost, is coming after Jung. And Jung starts screaming, let go, Diamond! You do not live your animal! You do not live your animal. This is what one of Jung's critiques of Christianity was. You have not lived your animal. You've not encountered the fact of you. Okay, so a ruckus is raised. The demon, Ezekiel, the Anabaptist, is wrestling with poor Jung in the kitchen. The librarian comes running in, hearing the chaos from the library, sees what's going on. He says, oh my God, call the police, a madman. Next thing we know, Jung is being carted off to the insane asylum. They carry him into the insane asylum. There are two doctors. One is clearly an old fat professor, he calls them, the old professor doctor. The professor, you know, so they sit him down to do their intake interview in the insane asylum. Professor, what's that book you've got there? Jung, it's Thomas A. Kempis, The Imitation of Christ. Professor, so, a form of religious madness. Perfectly clear. Religious paranoia. You see, my dear, nowadays the Imitation of Christ leads to the madhouse. Jung, that is hardly to be doubted, doctor. Professor, the man has wit. He is obviously somewhat maniacally aroused. Do you hear voices? Jung, you bet. Today it was a huge throng of Anabaptists that swarmed through the kitchen. Professor, now there we have it. Are the voices following you?
Oh, yeah.
Jung, oh no, heaven forbid, I summoned them. Professor, ah, this is yet another case that clearly indicates that hallucinations directly call up voices. This belongs in the case history. Would you immediately make a note of that, doctor? He says, addressing the younger doctor to his side. Jung says, with all due respect, professor, may I say that it is absolutely not abnormal, but much rather the intuitive method? Now, you have to understand that at this particular point, Jung was working on something he called the constructive or the hermeneutic or the intuitive method for interpreting imaginative and dream material. So Jung is replying to this professor using this this term, which he's only used in his writings. He hasn't published anything about this yet. So he says, with all due respect, Professor, may I say that it is not abnormal, but much rather the intuitive method. And the professor replies, excellent. The fellow also uses neologisms. You know, new words, make up new words for things. The fellow also uses neologisms. Well, I suppose we have an adequately clear diagnosis. Anyway, I wish you a good recovery. And make sure you stay quiet. Jung, but Professor, I'm not at all sick. I feel perfectly well. Professor, look, my dear, you don't have any insight into your illness yet. The prognosis is naturally pretty bad, with at best a limited recovery. And so Jung is led into the asylum, dormitory, and given a bed between two other madmen. Jung says, laying on his bed, looking at the two fellows next to him, I enjoy perfect silence. The problem of madness is profound. Divine madness. A higher form of the irrationality of the life streaming through us. At any rate, a madness that cannot be integrated into present day society. A madness that cannot be integrated into present day society. What if the form of a society were integrated into madness? At this point, things grow dark and there is no end in sight. A madness that cannot be integrated into present-day society. That's what Jung is working on in the Red Book. An exploration of the deepest levels of psychic imaginal experience met as autonomous facts. Mad? But Professor, I feel well. It's just the intuitive method. You've been hearing voices? Yes, I've been summoning them. Just saw a mad crowd of Anabaptists just ran through the kitchen. And then he asks, what if the form of society were integrated into madness? What if the form of society were integrated into madness? And on that thought, he ends, he says, he sees no end in sight. He goes to sleep in the madhouse. And then he writes this commentary a few months later. I can no longer say that this or that goal should be reached, or that this or that reason should apply, because it is good. Instead, I grope through mist and night. No line emerges, no law appears. Instead, everything is thoroughly and convincingly accidental. As a matter of fact, even terribly accidental. But one thing becomes dreadfully clear. Namely, that contrary to my earlier way and all of its insights and intentions, henceforth, all is error. It becomes even more apparent that nothing leads, as my hope sought to persuade me, but everything misleads. So he followed this path, and everything has become chaotic, it's become accidental. One night he's eating the dead child's liver. The next night he's in the kitchen with the cook, in the insane asylum with the old professor, in this absurd conversation. He had intentions. He thought something would lead him. And he has descended into chaos. This is late January of 1914. He says, and suddenly to your shivering horror, it becomes clear to you that you have fallen into the boundless, the abyss, the inanity of eternal chaos. It rushes toward you as if carried by the roaring wings of a storm, the hurtling waves of the sea. And that's really what he had meant at this point. Boundless abyss, eternal chaos, roaring wings of a storm, hurtling waves of a sea. In commentary, he goes on, he says, We have our walls, our smooth walls of daily consciousness, but they are, and I quote, frequently polished crust. They are a frequently polished crust over the mystery of chaos. If you break through this most everyday of walls, the overwhelming stream of chaos will flood in. Chaos is not single, but an unending multiplicity. It is not formless. Otherwise, it would be single. But it is filled with figures that have a confusing and overwhelming effect due to their fullness. Due to their fullness. I mean, when we talk about being overwhelmed by archetypal images, an image, due to its fullness that overwhelms us, has that power. These images have that sort of fullness, all of these. And then Jung has been had this encounter with the Anabaptists. He goes into a long contemplation about the relationship of the living to the dead. My family comes from a religion, and I've had some dealings with it myself, that has a sacred cult of the dead. So this stuff about the relation of the living and the dead is something I've had a chance to think about. And Jung thinks about this a great deal. I'll just give you a small piece of this. It's a weird idea, but Jung feels that there is a relationship of living and dead, of these Anabaptists from Zollerkhan in 1520, and the spirits rushing through his kitchen, or the cook's kitchen in the library. What ancients did for their dead. You seem to believe that you can absolve yourself from the care of the dead and from the work that they so greatly demand, since what is dead is past. You excuse yourself with your disbelief in the immortality of the soul. Do you think the dead do not exist because you have devised the impossibility of immortality? Do you believe in your idols of words? Idols of words. We live in a world of idols of words. Do you believe in your idols of words? The dead produce effects. That is sufficient. In the inner world, there is no explaining away, as little as you can explain away, the sea in the outer world. You must finally understand your purpose in explaining away, namely to seek protection. We explain away to seek protection from this inexplicable fact. I just have to interject here that Jung throughout his life felt a relationship to the dead. You remember I talked to you about his great-grandfather, the Antistes Samuel Preisfork, who had visions of the dead. His mother, who saw spirits in the house. His cousin, Helena Preisfork, Heli Preisfork, who did the seances, was channeling the dead. And one of the dead figures she channeled was her dead grandfather, the pastor Preisfork, and many others. There had been that in his background. Now he was meeting a horde of dead Anabaptists who hadn't found what they wanted on earth during their earthly lives, felt that something was missing, and Ezekiel is grabbing Jung by the collar and shaking him and saying, "Do you know what we've missed?" Jung gives him an answer. "You did not live your animal." I don't know if that's the answer Ezekiel was looking for, but that's the one that got Jung in the insane asylum. Have any of you felt that sort of thing? that connection with the dead? This is weird. It's a weird thing. But I'll tell you that sometimes I've felt that every human comes into this world with questions. We have our set of questions. I mean, they're different. We're different. We all have different questions. Some of our questions are weirder, so it seems, than others. But over the years, I've come to feel a fellowship across time with people who asked the questions that were my questions. You know, we don't all have the same questions. And if you're completely weird, you may not find anyone that has the same questions. And you feel totally isolated in asking weird questions. So you go looking for friends. And sometimes the friends you find, they're dead. They're long gone. But they're your friends. They had the same questions. They spent lives trying to answer these sorts of questions. And all of a sudden, they're not dead. They're alive in you, in your questions. It's a strange image. I don't know if I've explained that adequately, but I have experienced that.
Nietzsche has a wonderful image. Now, he is a genius freak. Like, he's a genius, but he's also a freak about geniuses, so you know, put it into some context. But he has an image of all the wise men and women, but he really says
men. But he's mainly men.
Over the millennia, and they sit on the mountaintops and talk to each other. And they can understand each other. They don't have cultural problems. They can understand each other. So they're all communing. Socrates says philosophy is preparation for death, but a lot of us think it's conversation with the dead.
Well, I don't know if this is what you're getting at.
I don't know either.
But it occurs to me that when I'm preparing different foods, I like to do it exactly like my mother and my grandmother taught me. And I think I have to confess I feel their presence. And it's a very comforting, happy experience. It's been very natural, and I've never thought of it very much. I mean, it's
just, but it's there.
It's something I do.
Well, I got to tell you, I shared that exact experience because my dad loved to make pies. He had a pretty high-pressure job, and during some of the years, he was chief of intelligence for East Asia in the Pentagon when the Vietnam War was starting. He was an intelligence officer. And it was the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was not an easy time. The way my dad relaxed is he'd come home from working at whatever time, and he'd bake a pie. And he was a great pie chef, and he took... And I remember him sitting me down when I was a teenager and showing me how to make the perfect pie crust because he was famous. His pie crusts were amazing. And every time I make a pie crust, that's my experience. I'm sitting there with my dad. That's, you know, it's like, it's that touching. It's just in that act. That's exactly, I think, what I heard there.
I have a fairly typical Christian background. But when I'm in a place where I don't really know how to move forward, and maybe it has to do with another generation or something I have no control over, I pray to my grandmothers. And I feel no guilt or concern whatsoever about that, and I think of it as praying to a particular energetic that they represented for me. And I've had a couple of instances that were so serendipitous following that it's like, so this and this happened, so that happened. Now that's interesting. So and I, you know, I have things of my mother certainly that I treasure because they were hers, and it brings a presence. So
spirit
how
presence.
Is that different than now? I'm not going into the dark side necessarily to get there.
No.
That's not who these women represent to
me. No, the Anabaptist was, that wasn't a dark side for you. I'm not talking about, you know, we're not talking about dark and light here. We're talking about something else. We're talking about a sense of...
Wait a minute. My ancestors were all bad cooks.
Were they bad cooks? Well, then I suggest you don't channel those, especially if I'm coming to dinner. And by the way, what night was that? Yeah, okay. But, you know, I guess you can burn the turkey and feel camaraderie with your ancestors as well. Well, you know, I mean, it certainly leads to a compassionate understanding of what they went through with life.
I have a little bit different way of relating to my ancestors. I undertook to understand what sort of people they were, what the society was at the time, what led them to be the people they were, that happened next, that brought us to today, where I have the family that I have. And it has given me compassion for them instead of feeling condemning towards them for cruelty and things like that. And I have noticed that in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition especially, they believe that you can heal your ancestors and your descendants by your own actions in this life in doing certain things. And they have a mantra and rituals and things related to that. But it has to do with that discovery about yourself and that wholeness that you bring into yourself. And in some other traditions, I've heard it called taking a thought or an experience out of the race mind consciousness where everybody is being influenced by certain attitudes and beliefs, if you can heal it within yourself sort of thing. And I think about that.
Well, have any of you had a, you must have, because it happens, an experience of a patient or somebody you were working with or yourself where you realized something in you was the effect of a grandparent that you never met? I've had a couple, I can think of one particular instance where somebody told me about something that was in them, that they had, through deep self-understanding, I was going to say analytic work, but I'd say self-understanding is probably a better way, really looking into themselves, saw how this thing in them had been passed to them from their grandfather, who they did not know, through their mother. Oh, alcoholism? How about that one? Generational transmissions? Not just addiction genes, but behavioral elements? The child of the alcoholic who never wants to drink, swears it off, demoned alcohol, traumatized to the depths by it. What's the shadow that falls on their children? Something from the grandparents? Jung felt, and this is sort of biographical information that I just throw in, he really did believe in something like reincarnation, but not in the simplistic sense, but in that just that issue of the question coming. And he felt a deep sense of relationship to, well, a couple historical figures I'll tell you. The first is Goethe. He really felt a connection to Goethe. He felt, indeed, that something in him was asking questions that Goethe had asked, that he was connected to it. And it has to do with a vision he had when he was just a child, when he saw an old carriage and buckled shoes one day. He really thought that was my carriage. Those are the types of shoes I used to wear. And then, of course, there was this legend he says he heard in his family that his grandfather, his father's father, whose name was also Carl Jung, Carl Gustav Jung, was an illegitimate son of Goethe. Jung took this pretty seriously, even if it was only a story. It was probably only a story, because Jung, when he did the research, could never put his great-grandmother at the right spot at the right time for her to have had Goethe's child. But she did travel in the same circle at one point. The other person he felt this deeply for was Meister Eckhart, the great German mystic. He felt that Meister Eckhart had many of the same perceptions that he shared. He felt deeply close to Eckhart. One also gets a sense from Jung, and you'll get this when you get to the Seven Sermons, that he felt something in him back at the beginnings of Christianity hooked up with Gnostic heresy. But that becomes a little more mystical and distant. Not to say that any of this isn't mystical and distant.
I hear in here a kind of pragmatist view that I associate with Nietzsche as well, and also with the turn of the century. He says the dead are affected, so they're real. Like, you don't have to make these sharp distinctions on what's real and not real.
And that's what Jung just said.
If it works, if it has power, it's real.
That's exactly what Jung says here. Is that the, and of course, Jung knew Nietzsche very well. Nietzsche had been a professor at Basel, where Jung was in school. Jung entered college when in 1894-5, and Nietzsche had really sort of left practice. I think it was about 1885. Is that ringing a bell?
He went mad 1889.
And I think he was really stopped teaching in maybe around 85. So, I mean, a decade before Jung entered the university at Basel, Nietzsche had been a professor there. He was well known in Basel. It wasn't that big a town, and he read Nietzsche. And in fact, if you look at Shyam Dasani's footnotes to the Red Book, you'll find many places like this one where Jung is quoting or referring to, alluding to Nietzsche, and Shyam Dasani in his editorial apparatus puts many of those notes in. We've only got 32 pages left. Let's see. There's something I did want to talk to about you. Let's see. Okay, this is it. So having gone, after this night in the insane asylum, the next night, the vision continues. And you know what happens? And then he has this encounter. He's in the insane asylum. He has another interview with the professor. And then, the next night, he wakes up. But he's sitting at the cook's table in the kitchen. So, what's been happening to Jung is he walked into the cook's kitchen with his book, copy of Thomas A. Kempis, sat down to read, and apparently fell asleep. And so the dream of the Anabaptists coming in, the dream of being taken to the insane asylum, that was all a dream inside a vision. And he wakes up, he's at the table. He had been dreaming that he had been in the insane asylum, that he'd had this conversation with the fat professor who had told him he was obviously a religious paranoid, a delusional case. Yeah. Have you ever had that happen to you? Have you ever had a dream where you woke up from the dream and you were still dreaming? Has that happened? Does it happen very often? It's only happened. There's one case that happened to me once. It was just so extraordinary. And I was thinking about this before the lecture, and I was thinking, well, has it only happened once? And I could get a glimmer of another time when it sort of happened, except I stayed asleep. I didn't really wake up. In other words, I woke up inside the dream from a dream, but I still kept dreaming and went on. But there's one dream I had where I'll tell you the dream because it applies to this stuff. I dreamed I murdered my brother. I don't have a brother. But I murdered my brother. And I don't remember the details, but I remember that I was trying to somehow hide myself from this crime in the... I shouldn't be telling this to a bunch of them. I see all these analytical faces here. Oh, no. Okay. I've started. So. All right. I dreamt that I had, and I was trying to hide from this fact or bury the body or something like that. And I was in abs, I was just, I felt dreadful. I was confronting the fact of the murder, that I was a murderer, that I had murdered, and I was trying to hide from the murder. And I woke up from the dream. And when I woke up, there was a sense of incredible relief. And I opened my eyes. I was in my bedroom. It was actually light outside, and I was sitting there, and I sat on the side of the bed, and I thought, thank God, that was just a dream. And then I started thinking, it wasn't just a dream. That was the truth. I really did it. I did it. I was sitting there on the side of my bed looking out the window into the yard, totally awake, and thinking, I did it. And then I was going to stand up, and I was holding my head. I was going to stand up, and then I realized I couldn't stand up because I was still asleep. I was sound asleep. And then I really woke up, and it was exactly the same room. It was bright. I sat there on the side of the bed, and I thought, thank God, that was a dream. And then I thought, oh, shit, it's still true. That was really right at the beginning of this, my process of getting into Jungian analysis, that I realized that this dream from which I had awakened, that I was so happy wasn't true, and realized was true, that I awakened from was so happy wasn't true, was true. You know what I did? I grabbed my Bible, I went down to my office, and I read the story of Cain and Abel. And that was an interesting reading. It was an interesting day to read that story. I thought about that for a long time. In fact, I realized I'm still thinking about it. You know, that's been almost 30 years ago. Sometimes it happens. So this happens to you. And so he awakens. He awakens from the vision. And then he says in commentary about all of this, this is the night in which all the dams broke, where what was previously solid moved, where the stones turned into serpents and everything living froze. Is this a web of words? If it is, it's a hellish web for those caught in it. But for him who has seen the chaos, there is no hiding, because he knows that the bottom sways and knows what this swaying means. He has seen the order and the disorder of the endless. He knows the unlawful laws. He knows the sea and can never forget it. The chaos is terrible. Days full of lead, nights full of horror. If you accept the lowest in you, suffering is unavoidable. Since you do the base thing and build up what lay in ruin, there are many graves and corpses in us, an evil stench of decomposition, mist and night. No line emerges, no law appears. Instead, everything is thoroughly and convincingly accidental. As a matter of fact, even terribly accidental. But one thing becomes dreadfully clear. Namely, that contrary to my earlier way and all of its insights and intentions, all is henceforth error. And suddenly, you are shivering in horror. It becomes clear to you that you have fallen into the boundless, the abyss, the inanity of eternal chaos. It rushes toward you as if carried by the roaring wings of storm, the hurtling waves of the sea. From this point on, the whole tone of Liber Novus changes in the dialogues. All of a sudden, Jung really is hanging. I mean, he is actually literally hanging at a point in this coming story, between above and below. His soul now becomes an intermediary. He recognizes her as the one who can travel into the depths and into the heights. She becomes a serpent and a dove. And he starts petitioning her to call forth things from above and from below and to meet them. At this point, we've pretty much come through the major issues in Liber Secundus. This is the material that after August of 1914, that Jung started writing up into a manuscript that would become the Red Book. After he had written that manuscript that would be the Red Book, in late 1914 and early 1915, things broke loose again. They started again in the summer of 1915, a year after pretty much he had been done with his first set of visions. He went a year without dealing with this chaos. What he was doing is he's going back and analyzing what had happened to him, trying to write a commentary layer, trying to bring consciousness to this, conceiving that this was a revelation of sorts, that a book had to be written. When it would be shown, he did not know. When he could reveal it, he did not know, but it had to be written. And then as he started working on the book, the transcription into the big red book, in late August 1915, things broke loose again. And he wrote a third section, recounting events principally from this period, from this fall of 1915 through the summer of 1916. This third section of Liber Novus he called Scrutinies. It exists only in manuscript form. Jung completed the manuscript of what he originally intended in 1914 to be the Red Book, finished it. It's 1,206 pages, I think, in manuscript. Had a typescript made. Tony did the typescript. Then he started transcribing it in the calligraphic volume, probably in mid-1915. And then things break loose again, and he has more things happen. And he writes a second manuscript that will be called Scrutinies. And Scrutinies never is copied into the Red Book. In fact, he never finished copying the first manuscript into the Red Book. We're getting to about the point in all this stuff in Liber Secundus where he stopped transcribing. He worked on this quite persistently and religiously from, certainly early 1915 onward, transcribing material into the Red Book. And then around 1918, it slows down. In the early 1920s, he's going very, very slowly, a page here, a page there. And in 1928, he stops trying to transcribe his original manuscript, just of this stuff that happened in the winter of 1913-1914, between January and April of 1914. He stops. Why? Because he sees that he has to take another road. There has to be another way of disclosing what he's been through. He knows at this point he cannot show anyone this book. There has to be another road. And so he starts an entirely new hermeneutic exegetical project, still based upon these experiences. And the manuscript of Scrutinies, which he wrote 1917, 1918, about the events in 16 and 17, was simply placed with the manuscript typescript and handwritten draft scripts of the Red Book together in his files. When Dr. Sonu Shandasamy did the translation of the Red Book that we have, he gave us not only the Red Book, as far as Jung transcribed it, really ending, the transcription work ending around 1928, when he was only about two-thirds of the way through his primary manuscript. But he gives us the translation of all the stuff he had not yet transcribed, based upon his handwritten and draft typescripts. And then he adds in the draft manuscript of Scrutinies. Scrutinies is a very important part. And in Scrutinies, Jung gives the summary of his Red Book experience. It's called the Seven Sermons to the Dead. It is the summary revelation of the Red Book. It's the only part of the Red Book Jung disclosed during his lifetime. He said it was a prelude to everything he had to say to the world. Seven sermons to the dead. Who were the dead? On January 30th, of 1916, Jung was having family dinner when the bell of his house rang. In those days, a bell was actually a bell, you know, a front door bell. You pull the cord, the bell rings at the other end of the cord in the kitchen. He went to the door. There was no one there, but a horde of Anabaptists. "We have come back from Jerusalem where we found not what we sought." That's how the Seven Sermons begins. Jung tells the story in Memories, Dreams, Reflections about the bell ringing, about going to the door, about the horde of spirits coming in. What he didn't tell you is in a dream, in a vision, he had met Ezekiel and this crowd of spirits when they were on their way to Jerusalem 2 years earlier. Now they came back, they went to pray at the Holy Sepulchre, they found not what they sought. And so they've come to Jung to answer their questions. And 2 years later, he was ready. We'll talk about that at the beginning of our next and last session. And then in the last half of next time, I want to talk about that paper I wrote. It's called Jung and I on Time, Vision, and a Wayfaring Man. I want to talk about the summary of Jung's vision, of what this man saw, awaiting the spirit, the soul, the humankind of our age. Thank you again, ladies and gentlemen. Good night.